The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Clara Park. I live here in Philadelphia, and I'm a chef. I have the honor of teaching classes right here at the Parkway Central Library as an instructor at the Culinary Literacy Center, and I'm a new member of the Culinary Literacy Council. The Culinary Literacy Center offers classes in our teaching kitchen on the fourth floor and at our neighborhood libraries that advance literacy, build connections, and promote community health. These classes, along with so many other enriching library programs, including our award-winning author event series, are made possible through the generous support of people like you. We would be grateful for your gift to help us in our mission to advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity for all Philadelphians. The library is one of our most important civic institutions. Please consider becoming a member or making a gift to the Free Library Fund that will help the library continue to offer its transformative resources. It is my great privilege to introduce our guest this evening, one of the world's foremost chroniclers of the intersection of the human and natural worlds. Michael Pollan is a number one New York Times bestselling author of 8 books. These works include How to Change Your Mind, An Examination of the Science of Psychedelics, Cooked, which was adapted into a Netflix series, Food Rules, An Eater's Manual, and The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of 4 Meals, which won the James Beard Award and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. A contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine for 35 years, Pollan has earned 2 James Beard Awards and the Genesis Award from the Humane Society of the United States, among numerous other honors. He is the co-founder of the UC Berkeley Center for the Science of Psychedelics and is the Knight Professor of Science and Journalism at UC Berkeley. A challenge to rethink traditional notions of drugs, This Is Your Mind on Plants explores the allure, taboos, and effects of 3 very different psychoactive plants. Tonight, Mr. Pollan will be in conversation with Tam Edwards, anchor of 6 ABC Action News Morning Edition. We are so pleased to have them with us this evening. Please join me in welcoming Michael Pollan and Tam Edwards to the Free Library.
Thank you.
Well, first we have to say to Michael, it's so good to have him back. We were chatting backstage, and you said it's been, what, about 10 years?
Yeah, I think
and a pandemic?
Was here in 2013, talking about Cooked. Yeah.
And so a lot of people probably read How to Change Your Mind, talking about psychedelics. And this one, as she just pointed out, we talk about opium, about coffee, and about mescaline.
Right.
And I wondered, you know, the especially the opium one, has a throwback to a famous essay that you wrote and sort of updating it. What got you to this book? Was it wanting to continue something out of the previous book, wanting to refresh that essay, or something completely different that took you to these 3 things?
Well, this book, the genesis behind this book is like not a wonderful story, but the true story. I mean, everybody has an origin story for any book. It's in the introduction, and you know, sometimes they're true. In this one, I had done the caffeine chapter that you mentioned, the middle chapter of this, as an Audible original. Audible, the audiobook people had come to me and said, we'd like to have you do an original piece that wouldn't be in print, and they made an offer that I couldn't refuse. In that, no, I don't mean financial, but they said. I said, how long are these things? And they said, a minimum of 15,000 words. And this is music to my ears. Normally you hear a maximum of 6,000 words or 7,000 words. But they were like, we're going to pay you by the word, and just, you got to get over 15,000. And that was very attractive. So, I mean, I like writing long. I like writing these very, I like digressions. I like being able to put it all in. And so I wrote this piece for Audible and then read it and delivered it. And it really annoyed my book editor that I had done this thing that she didn't know about. And she said, but I think it belongs between covers. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, there's two other stories I'd like to do that are drug related. And one was revisiting this piece on opium, which I can tell you about. And the other was when I was writing How to Change Your Mind, which stayed very close to the science of psychedelics. You have to remember, just 2018, it was a very fringy topic. There wasn't a lot of mainstream writing about psychedelics yet. And so I stuck to, you know, Johns Hopkins and NYU and UCLA Medical Center, because I was trying to show people this was serious stuff and worth paying attention to. But I was ignoring the fact that there was this indigenous use of psychedelics that went back thousands of years, and that the Native American Church, which is a very active, I mean, it's 80 different tribes, 250,000 American Indians, have been using peyote, which is the cactus that mescaline comes from, with incredible success, you know, as an aid to healing, as community building, and it's very conservative. You know, we think of psychedelics as very disruptive to society, and in Indian communities, it's the opposite. So I felt like I had overlooked that, and I wanted to do that. And so it was kind of a kapotchke of things, this book, you know, putting these three together. And they're unified by the fact that I have this longstanding interest in why it is that humans like to change consciousness, and we all do. And, you know, we may say that drug takers are over there, but all of us are involved with caffeine, or virtually all of us are involved with caffeine. And I think that's really interesting. Why aren't we content with everyday normal consciousness? Why do we need to sharpen it? Why do we need to just vary it? So that question has concerned me for a long time. So long answer to your good question.
And there's, as with all your books, some really great history in there. You're speaking about the Native American Church. One of my favorite lines was, you go to church to talk about Jesus, we go to church to talk to Jesus.
To Jesus, yes. Well, you know, that's part of the reason I think that psychedelics have been stamped out repeatedly. Because when the conquistadors got to the New World, they encountered people in what is now Mexico who were using psilocybin mushrooms in their religion, and they called it Tiahuatl. I'm sorry, I'm not pronouncing it right. But it was flesh of the gods. So it was a sacrament in the same way the Eucharist is, right? The flesh of Jesus and the blood of Jesus. And yet they really encountered God when they took their sacrament, and it made the Catholic one seem a little thin. So they crushed these mushroom cults as fast as they could. And they went underground. And this has happened. And this happened with the Native American Church too. There were many efforts to crush their use of peyote. Right up into the 1990s, the Supreme Court took away their right to use it. They had a fight to get it back.
You try everything. There's opium, there's poppy tea, there's getting off coffee because you're on coffee
right
when you start. And you tried two different forms of mescaline, one synthetic and one natural. And in a nutshell, because I'm sure this is one you get, how would you describe the various experiences to people comparatively, since they're all in the book, and what they did for you?
Yeah. So, you know, I think, well, I do participatory journalism or immersive journalism. I mean, no, I've done it long before I was writing about drugs. You know, when I was writing about the cattle industry, I bought a steer and followed it through the whole meat process. I built a house when I wanted to write about architecture. I really like to find a way to put myself in the story. I think one of the most influential books I read as a teenager was George Plimpton's book, Paper Lion, where he really reinvented sports writing by he persuaded the Detroit Lions to let him start as a quarterback in an exhibition game. And he saw football in a way no one had seen it. Because even if you have a very good writer who's a football player, they've been playing since they were kids. They don't have that first sight, that wonder of doing something for the first time. There's something you get when you're doing something for the first time, describing it for the first time, that you'll never have again. And so I try to put myself in that position when it's appropriate in my writing. And so when I knew I was writing a book about psychedelics, there was no question in my mind that I was obliged, in the interests of my readers, to have these experiences. Although in the case of caffeine, the experience was giving it up, which was harder, frankly, than taking any of the stuff I've taken, with maybe one exception. That was a challenge from a scientist that I was interviewing, Roland Griffith, at Johns Hopkins, who's, in addition to being, he's the leading caffeine expert in the country. And he said, you're never going to understand your relationship to caffeine or any drug unless you give it up for a period of time. And I thought that was good advice. And it was a challenge. And it certainly was a challenge. I gave it up for 3 months. You know, every one of these molecules has a different kind of a quality to the experience, or what the philosophers would call a phenomenology. I was surprised that mescaline, which is a psychedelic like LSD and psilocybin, was a very different kind of experience than either of those. Mescaline, which you don't find around that often, I was very lucky to come into possession of some. I wanted to have this experience. It was during the pandemic, and I was feeling very claustrophobic, and I thought, this is a great time to take a psychedelic and just travel, you know, in a way we can't travel otherwise. And so I thought it would do what psychedelics had done, which is take me somewhere else. But it didn't at all. There were no hallucinations, and there seldom are. What it seems to do is deeply absorb you in the here and now to a greater extent than you ever have been absorbed. And I could, you know, stare at a bowl of apricots for like an hour and really get a lot out of it. and so I was just present. I was just present to everything. We were in this house on the water in Tamales Bay when I did this. And my wife was just kind of babysitting me. We didn't have enough for both of us. And I had the book to write. And I was just completely absorbed with everything in my environment. And you know, my claustrophobia gave way to this incredible sense of sufficiency. Everything I need is right here. I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to leave the house. I can just look out the window. And it was fascinating that way. It was very gentle. The only negative, as far as I was concerned, is it's a really long experience. It's like 12 or 14 hours. And I, at a certain point, I just wanted to have dinner and go to bed. And the mescaline wasn't done with me. So anyway, it was interesting. Caffeine, we all know, although I have to say, you don't know it the way you would know it if you gave it up and got back on it. I found that a cup of coffee after 3 months off was as powerful as any experience I've had on a drug. It was euphoric. Since most of you are addicted at this point, you're getting a maintenance dose. I mean, in other words, when you take caffeine, you're going back to baseline because you're starting overnight. Caffeine has this amazing it synchronizes with our body rhythm so that we can go to sleep and get through the night without it waking us up to have more. But by the time we wake up in the morning, we're starting to go through withdrawal. And you know, you talk to people who say, don't talk to me till I've had my cup of coffee. And that's, they're beginning to feel withdrawal. And it's a very distinctive feeling, and you feel kind of muzzy-headed and cranky. And then you have your coffee, and you feel much better, and you're kind of restored to baseline. But that's not the full effect of the drug when there's none in your system. And you can get this effect, just give it up for a week. Someone's nodding, no, impossible. And it was just euphoric. I describe it in the book. I was just such a, felt great. And I got so much done. I like cleaned out my closet. I killed like 100 listservs in my email queue that were really annoying me. I just, it was a great experience. But now I have it every day, and I still enjoy it. I appreciate it. But what was striking about giving up caffeine was that for this whole period, I mean, there was the withdrawal, which took like a week or two and was really unpleasant, and I was useless. I had a lot of trouble focusing. But after I kind of was able to work again and it was out of my system, I didn't feel quite myself the whole time. And how odd is that, that myself was a caffeinated self, and I didn't feel normal without it, and that it is now so deeply woven into my experience of reality that I felt like somebody else without it. And so I've been, you know, I've been using caffeine every day since I was like 10. I got an early start on coffee. And so anyway, I'm back on, happily back on. But not a whole lot. And I try to, I mean, the only negative thing about caffeine, I did a lot of work to like do the research. Is it bad for you? Is it good for you? It's mostly good for you, remarkably good for you, and proven to improve memory and endurance and mental sharpness, all these kind of things. The only negative is it if you drink a lot of it or you drink it late into the day, it disturbs a particular kind of sleep that you really need, deep sleep or slow wave sleep, which is kind of when your brain does its housekeeping overnight and stores memories in the proper place and cleans off the desktop. And if you're not getting that kind of sleep, it is a predictor for all sorts of health problems. So it's a good idea to stop your caffeine ingestion around noon, if you can.
And it seemed as though the opium, it was less so taking you somewhere else as much as making you feel better here. Mm. That it was its own, the same feelings that you might think with a Tylenol or something else, I feel better. And it was
very
gentle.
It was very subtle. I mean, this was not opium that I was smoking or injecting or anything. This is, so I grew opium in my garden many years ago as an experiment. And I got into some hot water. I wrote this piece for Harper's Magazine. This is back in the 90s. This is at the height of the drug war during the Clinton administration, which really was the height of the drug war, even though it was started by Richard Nixon. And I was writing columns on what was happening in my garden. My first book, Second Nature, is all about what I was learning about our relationship to nature as a gardener. And somebody sent me this book called Opium for the Masses. It was an underground press book, and it was like, wow, you can grow your own opium from legally available seeds? I had no idea. Papaver somniferum. You can buy the plants in a garden center. But you can take the seed heads and chop them up and either soak them in hot water and get a poppy tea or soak them in vodka and get laudanum, which was very popular in Victorian times. And I was like, let me see if I can do this. Along the way, I learned it was very illegal, even though the seeds were legal. But what was weird about it is it was only growing poppies is only illegal if you know that they are a Schedule I substance. If you don't know that, you're fine. So all of you now cannot legally grow. But in my case, they could prove it because I was writing about it. And so I wrote this article, and it ends up being this story about the drug war. And I was shocked to learn that, indeed, this very simple act of growing something in my garden could cost me my freedom, cost me my house and land. Just how, how serious the drug penalties were then, and that the DEA was looking at this whole thing and very worried about this guy's book starting a fad for people growing their opium. So they were quietly busting people and quietly going around to seed companies and telling them not to carry these perfectly legal seeds. So I finished the piece. I handed it into Harper's. They want to run it. And I said, well, we have to get a lawyer to read this. So they send it to a prominent criminal defense lawyer who reads it and drives up to my house. At the time, we lived in Cornwall, Connecticut, and sits my wife and I down while my four-year-old is napping upstairs and says, well, you know, this is a confession to a federal crime. You can't publish this. There's no way you can publish this. I was a freelance writer at the time. And I've been working on this piece all year. I was counting on this payday. And I just learned I couldn't publish it. It was pretty devastating. And I'd already written 15,000 words about it. So when the publisher heard this, his immediate reaction was, "We need a new lawyer." classic. So he then hired a very prominent First Amendment lawyer who insisted we go forward. Was happy to, you know, make law over my dead body. I did say, "Well, what can I do to protect myself?" And he said, "You can do a couple things. One is, don't include the recipe for how to make poppy tea, and don't include the trip report on what it felt like." So I cut those sections out, and I always felt bad about this. I mean, it was self-censorship. And I got those passages off the property. I gave them to one of my brothers-in-law who was a lawyer, and you know, hid them as carefully as I could, and then went ahead and published. I also got assurances from the magazine, which were kind of incredible, that if anything happened to me, they would not only defend me, but they'd pay me a salary during this whole period I was incarcerated, if that happened, and if they took my house, all this was happening routinely. And if they took my house under asset forfeiture laws, they would buy me a new one. So it was a very good contract. The publisher, his name is Rick MacArthur, and he is a fierce defender of the First Amendment, and he should be congratulated for that. Not too many publishers would do that. Anyway, nothing happened, luckily, and years went by, and I learned many years later that something else was going on during this summer of fear and paranoia I was having, where I was, you know, worried that the police might knock on the door. I had been in email correspondence with the author of this book who had gotten arrested for possession of dried poppy heads he got at a florist shop. Nothing more. But I wanted to republish it and include this and restore it. And so when I decided I was doing this book on you know, with these long essays on several different drugs, that was my chance. And what I learned in the interim is that the summer the DEA was cracking down on a bunch of gardeners, you know, growing a little opium to make this mild tea, which is good if you have a bad back. I mean, it's not going to, you know, knock you out or anything. Purdue Pharma, that same summer, was introducing OxyContin. And the biggest public health crisis tied to drugs during this whole period began, of course, with the promotion of legal opiates to people that the company knew, the company pretended was a safer opiate and a less addictive opiate, things that we've subsequently learned they knew better. And, you know, last year more than 100,000 Americans died from opiate overdoses. And the drug war, you know, completely missed this. You know, if it really was a public health campaign, which is how it was presented to us, they missed the biggest public health problem related to drugs. So this piece became a kind of parable of the drug war.
And it, you say, "I doubt anybody's ever died from illicit poppy tea."
No, it would be very hard.
You lay out the case of Jim Hogshire, whose life is ruined, and it's not necessarily, I mean, when you think about it, it's not the possession, it's the knowledge, which is nuts.
Well, he would not have been, I mean, he got off, but they threw the book at him, and he had to defend himself, and it took years. But their proof that he had mens rea, the intent to make this Schedule I substance, was the fact he had published a book. So it was the book and the dried poppy heads made their case. And in my case, I had the same vulnerability because I had all my email correspondence with him and all the reporting I'd done on what I was doing. And, you know, I think they didn't want to come after somebody who was backed by a deep-pocketed publisher and would have been very embarrassing. But going after Hogshire's underground press book, and Hogshire, as far as I know, lives on the street now. It's really sad.
And to tell you how crazy this is, they're coming after him and they trample over his landlady's poppies.
Yes.
Which are in the front yard to get to him. And in fact, in the book, you know, a lot of it is, you make the point that how we think about drugs and classify drugs makes no sense. We're all, I'm going to do a lot of these drugs in the morning when it's time to go to work, when I make my cup of coffee. And yet, if you were to do two of the other ones, it's a completely different world. And you write, the war on drugs is in truth a war on some drugs, their enemy status, the result of historical accident, cultural prejudice, an institutional imperative. The idea that it doesn't really make any sense.
No, there's a lot of irrationality around drugs. That passage you're reading, the land in Connecticut where I was growing these poppies had been owned by an old farmer who was famous for, and there were these old apple trees, really old apple trees on the property, and he made Applejack during Prohibition. And this is an alcoholic farm cider. You basically make cider and then you freeze it and the alcohol doesn't freeze and you drink that. And this was a federal crime for 10 years, right, during Prohibition. A campaign that was fought by women who drank these women's tonics routinely that contained cannabis and opium. And that was considered fine while they were taking their hatchets to chop down apple trees, which were evil. And so we've gone through these changes of, you know, demonizing this substance. And frankly, it usually has to do with who's using the substance. They came after cannabis because African Americans and Mexicans were using cannabis. And Nixon, in fact, it came out after he died that the drug war, there was a quote given by John Ehrlichman, who was his domestic policy advisor, back in the 90s. And he said, he explained the drug war to this journalist, Dan Baum, and he said, our biggest enemies were the blacks and the hippies, is how he put it. And we knew if we could criminalize their drugs, cannabis and LSD, that we could disrupt their communities. And we could demonize them. And that's exactly what they did. So the drug war was a political move. It gave enormous power to the government. I mean, if you think about it, if you make cannabis illegal, and it still is in most places, you've given the police a very powerful tool because they can come in and chances are pretty good they can find it. And if they can't find it, sometimes they'll plant it. There's no easier crime to prove if you have the drug and the person, it's very easy. There's no elaborate detective work. And so this is what gave us mass incarceration. So the drug war is, you know, there are signs, I think, that it's fading and that people are ready to let it go in both political parties. We'll see. The police still really like having these laws on the books. It gives them this enormous tool. And they're still forfeiting lots of cars and houses and things. Those laws, they've been weakened somewhat, but they're still in effect. And police budgets depend on forfeited goods of various kinds. So anyway, we still have a ways to go. But now 35 states have decriminalized or legalized cannabis. And I think we're going to see psychedelics in the next few years lose their criminal status too.
And that's something you bring up in the book, that for as interesting as the history may be, the goats eating the coffee beans, and that causes us to figure out the wine of Araby is what coffee means. You also say there's a history that's hard to grapple with in that case, what it did to African Americans in the slave trade, and also in terms of sugar, in terms of coffee, and that we haven't really completely thought about what that has done.
Yeah, coffee and tea, I mean, if you look at it from the perspective of Western Europe and England, I mean, you know, these things can't be produced in the temperate north, so they are the products of colonialism and imperialism. And the English, to satisfy their tea habit, started growing opium in India and selling it in China because they were buying so much tea from China that they had a balance of a trade balance problem. And so they had, and there was nothing the Chinese wanted from the English. And So they figured out what something that they would take, and they actually pushed opium on the Chinese and grew a lot of it in India, and indeed went to war with China when China tried to close off the opium trade. In the 1840s, China realized that opium was a huge public health problem, and a great number of Chinese were addicted, and so they closed the ports to these opium clippers. And the British actually fought a war to reopen those ports, to open the lines of drug dealing. And so it's not a pretty picture. And the tea that the English were drinking was heavily sweetened with sugar, and sugar, of course, was a result of the slave trade. It was grown, sugar cane was grown in the Caribbean on plantations. And a lot of coffee was grown on plantations in Brazil as well. So yeah, there's a pretty dark history behind these substances. And most people who were enjoying coffee and tea in Europe had no idea of what it took to produce it or bring it to their cups.
But you said without it, maybe we would have had no Enlightenment, Industrial Revolution. And the coffee break is a real thing, that American ingenuity, a lot of it is those 15 minutes.
So one of the things that's really interesting about caffeine is, unlike a lot of other drugs, which have been used by humans for thousands of years, whether you're talking about cannabis or alcohol or whatever, coffee and tea don't show up in Europe until a very set moment in the 1640s in London. Before that, people were just drunk. No, really, that was, everybody drank. You gave alcohol to your kids, it might have been dilute. It was safer than water. And it was, and it's hard to imagine an industrial revolution with everybody drunk. It's not good for double entry bookkeeping. It's not good for operating heavy machinery. So when caffeine shows up, it's instantly very popular. Coffee houses spring up all over London. There are like 350 of them like this. And they're more popular than taverns. And people wrote about, they noticed this new sobriety in England. And obviously they didn't displace alcohol completely, but it cut down on it. And the reason for drinking alcohol, or one of the reasons, the fact that it was more sanitary than water, caffeinated drinks were even better because they were made with boiled water. That was the first time people drank boiled water. And of course, so the public health of the countries that got into coffee and tea immediately improved. But I'm not the first person to make this case, but there's a good case to be made that it had a powerful effect on the Enlightenment. All the great writers of the Enlightenment were major caffeine, Diderot had like 72 cups a day. Balzac was so into his coffee, and he had developed such a tolerance that at a certain point he stopped adding the hot water and just ingested the coffee grounds. And he did this every night, and he would write all night long. I can only imagine what his stomach looked like after a... But the coffee break that you mentioned is a really interesting institution. And if you need any proof that the introduction of caffeine benefited capital more than labor, look at the coffee break, right? Employers give employees a drug for free and time in which to enjoy it. And this was institutionalized in America beginning in the... Well, in the 20th century, but there were companies early in the 20th century that gave their employees coffee and tea, and then there were companies that gave them time, but they had to bring their own coffee and tea. But there was one company that figured out we're going to do both together, and it was going to vastly improve productivity. It was a necktie company in Colorado called Wigwam Weavers. And they were having, after their best workers went off to war, they were having a real problem with the quality and output of their neckties. And they asked the women who had taken over the looms, who were good, but after 4 or 5 hours, they would kind of lose their focus. What could we do? And the women said, well, give us time. Give us coffee and tea and give us 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon. And he tried it. And suddenly, their performance got better and the neckties were more beautiful, and he institutionalized the coffee break. Although he then went ahead, he tried to dock them for the 40 minutes of time off, but a judge ruled that, in fact, that was part of the workday, and so he had to pay them.
When you get to mescaline, that's a different issue in that very limited supply, and you come up against a fundamental argument. Many of the practitioners are Native American, and they say there's not enough, leave it for us.
Yeah.
Given the history, stay in your lane.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to talk about going through that and sort of where you find yourself in that argument today and whether or not you'd continue to do it, you think everybody should do it, or it should be left to Native Americans.
Well, okay, there are three different ways that you can get mescaline, which is the chemical compound, in peyote, in another, which is a very slow-growing, beautiful little cactus. It looks like a pincushion. It's on the cover of the book. Yes, that one. And or another cactus called San Pedro or Huachuma, which is, you can grow legally, not in this climate, but in California we can grow it legally. In the Sun Belt you can grow it legally. You could grow it inside. And then synthetic, made in a laboratory. The Native Americans exclusively use peyote. They eat these buttons, these cactus buttons, and it only grows in a very narrow band along the Rio Grande River in Texas and Mexico, an area that is being developed. There are cattle ranches on the Texas side, plus wind turbines going up, and so there's a shortage, and it's really important to the Native American church and their ceremonies. There was a controversy that popped up a couple years ago when a new movement called Decriminalized Nature got started. And they have chapters now in many cities, in 150 cities. And they're basically trying to decriminalize psychedelics, plant-based psychedelics. Decriminalized means not that they're legal, but that the city or the municipality instructs the police to make this their lowest priority. So it gives a level of safety to people using this. They included peyote in their blanket, plan to decriminalize plant medicine. And you can understand the logic. Their whole thing was, how can plants be criminal? And so to make an exception would have loused up the kind of neatness of their political platform. On the other hand, there is a real risk that if there is a fad for peyote, as there was in the 60s with Carlos Castaneda, that poachers would come in and there would not be enough peyote for Native Americans. And it is, I can't tell you just how important it is to their community. It's how they deal with alcoholism. It's how they deal with spousal abuse. It's how they deal with all these community issues that come up. And they have this ceremony, which is a very formulaic, highly ritualized ceremony. It takes place overnight in a tent around a fire. Very rigid. Everyone has to sit there and stare at the fire all night long. They pass the basket of peyote buttons, and people take however much they want. I wouldn't say they're tripping necessarily. I think what seems to happen is that the drug experience combined with the music, the singing, and the rhythmic drumming kind of puts everybody on the same page. I think there's a kind of entrainment that goes on, and then people focus all their attention and their prayers on the person that's being treated. Children participate, and they have the legal right to do this under a law that was passed during the Clinton administration. So this is like a beautiful use of a plant, and we have taken so much from Native Americans, and to take this now just seems criminal. And I talked to a lot of Native Americans I interviewed for this piece, and many of them are were saying, if you want to use mescaline, please use synthetic or use San Pedro. I finally came to the conclusion that the best way to show your respect for Native Americans and this practice was, as a white person or as a non-Native person, not to use it. And you know, it's no big hardship. So I tried to make that very clear in the book because I was concerned, and they were concerned that, you know, that my depiction of it would encourage people to want to do it. So I actually say here very clearly, and in the Netflix special series on based on How to Change Your Mind, that which has a section on mescaline, that yeah, I think we should lay off it.
We were talking a little bit backstage, and you were saying people imagine this all to excess, and the people who really use these drugs, it's not. It's something they use every now and then, and the experience is always different. And in the book, you get at something. You try the San Pedro with your wife, and the two of you have a very different experience. And I thought you might want to talk about that before we went to questions.
Yeah. So San Pedro is this other cactus that produces mescaline, and I worked with a woman who calls herself a medicine keeper, or ceremonial leader, and she arranged a ceremony that we did because I was curious to try once again, you know, so I could tell you about it. My wife participated, and she's had an interesting history with these substances. She was kind of reluctant. She was reluctant to have me do it at the beginning. She was afraid that it would change me in some ways, and she evidently liked me the way I was. And she was. It was weird to her that, you know, we'd had all these very big experiences together, you know, having a child and getting a mortgage and doing all these things, these big things together, and I was going to do something separately, have a, you know, supposedly transformative psychedelic experience or six. And but in the end, she was curious enough after hearing my stories to have a few experiences herself. And she was working on a very particular issue having to do with her relationship with her mother and some challenges there. And in this experience with the San Pedro, she had a very powerful experience in which she... I describe it at the end of the book. And it was very helpful to her, I think. I think it really shifted her relationship to her mother in a positive direction. And but it was intense, and it was intense to watch. I mean, there was a group of us. There were about eight people. And I wasn't affected by this very much at all. And there's a way in which, even on a strong psychedelic, that you can tune in when you have to. Like, some, you know, the FedEx guy comes to the door. You can handle it. it's a weird thing. You can kind of pull yourself together. But it became clear that she was having a challenging experience. And so I think that kind of sobered me up in a funny way. And I was very tuned to her, even though there's nothing I could really do to help her except just, you know, offer my support. So, yeah, she's in a way gotten more out of it than I have.
And you, in those two experiences, one, the mescaline, the synthetic, it's just the two of you. The second one is a ceremony. Native Americans say you really should do it in a ceremony. You've had both experiences. Was there one that you thought was preferable, having a little bit of that mescaline by yourself or doing the ceremony?
There's something really magic about a ritual use of a substance like this. I've also been in a couple ayahuasca circles, and there's something interesting that happens when there are other people in the room. I think there's a reason. So if you look at the way indigenous peoples have used psychedelics, and this use goes back in the New World at least 6,000 years, there's a few notable dimensions to what they do. They don't use these substances alone. It's always in a group, almost always in a group. There's always an elder involved to guide people through the experience. It's never done casually. It's always done with an intention, whether it's to, you know, treat somebody who has an illness or solve a problem in the community. And it's always surrounded by ritual. And I think that's really interesting. And I think... it's wise. I think this is the result of thousands of years of trial and error. Here is a safe container for these powerful substances. So I think that there's a lot to be said. I think there's a special energy. People get on the same wavelength. Even though people are going in their separate ways sometimes, there is an energy in the room that's pretty special. I mean, I've had very meaningful experiences on my own too, but I think, you know, I think as a culture we're still learning how to use these substances. They only arrived in the West in the 50s and 60s, and they came without an instruction manual. And we made a lot of mistakes in how we use psychedelics, especially that first round. You know, people thought it was okay to put LSD in the punch bowl at a party. And the CIA experimented with giving people drugs without telling them what they were getting. I mean, they dosed people unaware and with disastrous effects. I mean, I can't imagine anything more cruel. But we didn't know what these things were. That's part of the story I tell in How to Change Your Mind, is the history of figuring out what they're good for. It took a long time. Yet we had a model in our midst. And we were too arrogant to realize the wisdom that Native Americans had acquired about these drugs, or Mazatec Indians in Mexico, or the people who use Huachuma or San Pedro in Bolivia and Peru. We didn't think we had anything to learn from them, but we had a lot to learn from them. And now I think we're learning it. Hopefully, and with this medicalization and, you know, FDA approval of these things, we're developing our own kind of safe container in which to use them. But they definitely need a container. I mean, these are powerful substances, and they can be used. They can be used recklessly, and they can really hurt people. We haven't talked a lot about risk, but there are definitely risks involved.
Is there anybody who has a question?
Yeah, I'd love to hear from you guys.
I wanted to go back to something you started with. Why do people want to alter their consciousness?
Well, I don't know for sure. The question is it adaptive? And that, you know, because if you think about it, altering consciousness seems maladaptive, right? You're more likely to have an accident. You're not in command of your faculties. Your judgment is impaired. You would think that unless there was some compensating virtue, that natural selection would have selected out the drug takers by now, right? As people who just kind of fell downstairs and screwed up or were preyed on by, you know, mountain lions and things like that because they didn't know what was going on. But we seem to have survived. So what's the virtue? I think there are a couple virtues. I mean, I think boredom or a cure for boredom is not trivial. I think for most of history, people have not had television and books and all the things we have to distract ourselves, and that drugs were a way to deal with the monotony of life. I think that was one thing. I think pain relief is a huge thing. I mean, for most of history, medicine did not have cures or treatments. It really had pain relief, and opiates were obviously central to that, but cannabis too and other drugs. But I also think that drugs have made a contribution to cultural evolution. And I talk about this in the book. In the same way that mutations or mutagens like radiation create more variety in a population, most of those mutations are really bad, go nowhere, but every now and then a mutation comes along that changes the species in a positive way, opens up new possibilities. I think that happens in the cultural realm too, and as with genes, so with memes, which is to say cultural ideas or bits of cultural information. And we have a whole history of people, some we know about, some we don't know about, whether they're scientists or artists, who have been profoundly affected by a drug experience and gotten a great insight. I mean, there are, you know, there are stories of scientists who were able to imagine DNA and the shapes of molecules on LSD. There were artists who, you know, had insights and philosophers. And there's, you know, more and more people are talking about this because it's come out of the closet. Recently, Carlo Rovelli, the great theoretical physicist, Italian theoretical physicist, said, it was an LSD trip when he was in high school that made him realize that he wanted to be a physicist and made him understand why all these very weird ideas like multiverse and string theory and everything might be true. Carrie Mullis, who invented the PCR that we're all the beneficiaries of, the ability to multiply DNA, figured that out on an LSD trip, and he's talked about that. And then, you know, you've got all the poets, you know, with their opiates, Coleridge and other romantics. So I think that, I think in general, the insights people come up with on drugs are probably mostly not very good or not very interesting. I would say like 98% maybe of like these profound ideas that in the morning aren't really so profound. But every now and then, the encounter of a certain molecule with a certain mind produces something that benefits everybody. And so that would be my answer.
First of all, I want to thank you for your contribution to like the bringing this into the mainstream conversation. I want to ask, you touched on kind of topics you covered and how to change your mind regarding, you know, psychedelic therapy and the introduction of that into our mental health care treatment. I'm wondering what you see as the future of psychedelic use in the West, and as well as how you think we could avoid certain, you know, pitfalls that occurred in the, you know, 50s and 60s.
Yeah, it's a good question. So I see, you know, we're talking about the future here, right? So it's all speculation. But I see a couple different paths on which psychedelic compounds like psilocybin and MDMA, which is ecstasy, it's not exactly a psychedelic, but often lumped together, will re-enter our culture or advance. One is the medical model, and this is proceeding. I mean, within 2 years, MDMA will be federally approved. They've already had very successful phase 3 studies for the treatment of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And the results have been very impressive. So this is going to happen. That'll probably be the first one. Psilocybin as a treatment for depression will probably be approved within 5 years. That is now in phase 3 testing. We've only seen phase 2. But the results are also impressive. Not quite as impressive, but impressive. Psilocybin also is showing very good results in treating addiction. And in treating OCD and a couple other, it's being trialed for eating disorders now, which is a very exciting application because we don't have anything to treat eating disorders. So I think this medicalization path is happening. Will that be the only path? No. I mean, these drugs are still in the culture and they'll continue to be a very vibrant underground where people can get treatment from this network of underground guides, which is growing very quickly. I think another path on which these drugs are traveling is this religious path. I think that in the same way you've had the recognition that there's a legitimate sacramental use of psychedelics by Native Americans, there are two other churches or religious traditions that have been recognized. One is, they're both ayahuasca churches, and they have gotten recognition. And there are new psychedelic churches popping up all over the place right now, with psilocybin, with LSD. And, you know, some of them sound kind of dubious as churches, but given the jurisprudence of this Supreme Court around religious freedom, they are so radical in their willingness to defer to anyone who declares a religious interest. I think they're going to have a lot of trouble turning down these churches when they get to, you know. So I think this is like the great exploding cigar in Samuel Alito's future. but we'll see. Now, consistency has also never been their strong suit. But so I think that actually, one of the ways people will use psychedelics is joining a church that uses psychedelics, and that this will be a strikingly common thing in 5 or 10 years.
And he said anything that we could learn from the 50s and 60s to not do.
Yeah, don't put it in the punch bowl. No, I think that I think as a cultural project, I think figuring out the safest way to use this. I mean, in a way, this is kind of happening in the underground and has been since the 50s. You know, in the Netflix series, there's a lot on the history of LSD in the 50s, and they used to just like kind of come in, give you your, you know, drop your LSD on your tongue, put you in a fluorescent room, and leave. And people had some really bad experiences. And then along the way, there's this famous character, Al Hubbard, who was an amateur but very involved in this work in the 50s. He says, no, it's got to be like, you got to set it up like a nice living room. You want some nice pictures and maybe a Buddha. Or actually, he was very Catholic, so he would have, you know, a crucifix somewhere and a rose and nice music. And so we evolved a different way of using it. And then we evolved this idea of wearing eye shades during the guided trip to kind of make you go inside, have a very internal experience, which was more psychologically useful, and music and the role of music. And so I think this work of kind of optimizing the experience outside of a medical context is work that still needs to be done, and there's more work to be done that way. So, you know, one of the interesting things, Andrew Weil said this a long time ago in a book called The Natural Mind, really wise book about drugs written in the 70s, that people who use drugs in a ritual way are much less likely to get in trouble with them. Hmm. And this goes even for alcohol. We have rituals in our society around that you know, you don't drink alone, you drink with other people in a social situation, and you often drink with food, and you don't drink in the morning, or you don't drink all day long. And these little rituals, we don't even think of them as rituals, have a protective effect, and we need to devise similar rituals around psychedelics. So I think it's important cultural work that needs to be done. And we learn from other groups who are using them, who have more experience than we have. And I think there's a way to, but it has to be culturally appropriate, obviously. We're not going to go into a teepee and bang drums, and that would be cultural appropriation anyway. But there are basic principles on how other people have used them successfully that I think we would do well to observe and mimic.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful. So when I read This Is Your Mind on Plants, it seemed to me like the focus was mostly about how when we decide when to use certain plants. When I read The Botany of Desire, it seemed like it was all about how the plants control us. And so I was curious, you know, as an author, how do you decide when we control the plants versus when the plants control us?
Well, thank you. It's a good question. I think the same rules are in effect, actually, in this book, especially when I talk about coffee, how what we have done for this plant, that the coffee plant, you know, hit on this strategy about 1,000 years ago in the Eastern Africa. This was a plant that had a very small habitat in Ethiopia. As you mentioned, some herder supposedly, you know, saw that his goats would get frisky and stay up all night when they ate the berries off this one particular tree, and then he decided to try it, or he brought it to a monastery where they made a drink out of it and discovered it. So the result for the caffeine producing plants has been incredible success, worldwide domination. I mean, they have like 25 million acres of habitat ringing the tropics, you know, the high altitude tropics. It's quite a, and you know, think of what we do for coffee and for tea. So I still see things that way. And I see plants as really ingenious. I mean, another example, one of the more surprising and exciting bits of research I came across was, you know, caffeine in nature, before we discovered that it changed our consciousness in nice ways, was a pesticide. Like a lot of drugs, alkaloids are, the plant initially concocts this molecule to defend it against predators, against insects or animals. And it just so happens that it does this by messing with their minds. And then we come along and we figure out, actually, this pesticide is a great, you know, mood changer. But even in the insect world, there is a group of plants, citrus among them, the citrus family, that actually produces caffeine in their nectar, in the flowers. Now, nectar is not where you put a pesticide. It's where you're attracting insects. And they have found that small amounts of caffeine in flowers attracts more bees than not. And that, in fact, bees will, this was just discovered a few years ago, will remember where they found flowers that gave them caffeine. They will go back to those plants preferentially, even after there's no nectar left. And they're more likely to remember. It improves their memory. And they've tested this in these bees. So basically, it does the same thing for bees it does for us. It makes us better workers and more faithful pollinators in the case of the plants. So, you know, I have enormous respect for the ingenuity of plants to have figured this kind of stuff out. And they're often in charge. And I think when it comes to these drug plants, that's definitely the case. Not peyote, though. That's a wild plant that hasn't been domesticated. And you could argue it hasn't benefited from our attention yet. In fact, because we're not spreading it. We can't spread it. It won't grow everywhere. It's very picky. And it takes 15 years to get from seed to usable bud. So that's truly a wild plant that would rather we, I think, left it alone.
I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on how a person might explore some of these drugs while parenting young children?
While parenting young children?
Hypothetically.
It might not be the best time. You know, it's funny, when I've spoken about psychedelics, when I first started speaking about it in 2018, when How to Change Your Mind came out, I would often be in small rooms talking to people. I remember a couple events that my publisher, arranged for me to meet editors and producers and things like that. And I could often tell when there was like somebody who was kind of clenching with a lot of resistance that I was saying positive things about psychedelics. And it was often somebody and it was usually a woman in her 30s and 40s who had young children at home. Because it's complicated, and it's a complicated conversation. I mean, the drug conversation is always complicated. And that was where there was the most reluctance to explore this whole idea. I don't know what I would have done. So my son, we have one child, and he was already off, I think he was even out of college or in college when I started having these adventures for the book. So it wasn't that difficult to talk to him about it. He had had his own experiences, I mean, somewhat limited, but he shared his experiences with me and I did with him. He was kind of curious about Dad's psychedelic trips. And so he would debrief me after some of my adventures. But if he were 14, I'm not sure how I would have handled it, honestly. I didn't face that. I think these drugs could have a very powerful effect on a teenager. And, I think that ego dissolution, which is actually something you kind of seek with these experiences and is very productive if you're stuck or struggling with rumination or depression or anxiety, before you have a fully developed ego, that might not be a good idea. I think there'll be a time in your life where you will find it valuable. There's a throwaway line in How to Change Your Mind where I say that, it may be that psychedelics are wasted on the young, that they have particular value as you get older, as you get stuck in habits. We get into these grooves, and all of us have habits that we regard as destructive in one way or another, whether they're of thought or of behavior. I think that one of the best and highest uses of psychedelics is help to get us out, nudge us out of those grooves, and write some new narratives about ourselves and who we are and what we can do. You know, that's not to say there aren't young people who haven't had incredibly valuable transformative experiences. But it's not something I've explored in the same way, because I didn't use psychedelics at that age. I was too afraid to. But I, you know, we haven't talked about risk, and there really are risks. It's important to understand that there are people who are, you know, at risk for schizophrenia or psychosis and of other types, personality disorder, that these drugs are not a good idea for. And it's really important people use them in a safe environment. Set and setting is really important, that you have a good mind, you're in a good place when you do it. You need to be somewhere you can really surrender to the experience, which is not walking down a city street, you know. They shouldn't be approached casually. It's a really momentous thing to do at high dose. I mean, microdose is a different question entirely. So anyway, so the risks, but the risks are not around addiction. They're not addictive, which is astonishing. And they're also not particularly toxic. Believe it or not, the classic psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin are less toxic than Tylenol. You know, if you take 20 Tylenols, you will destroy your liver and probably die. There's no known lethal dose of psilocybin or LSD, which is quite remarkable. There are very few drugs like that.
Hi, thank you so much. You know, I think it's really exciting that so many individuals are so enthusiastic about psychedelics and that they're kind of emerging from different groups, whether they're coming in as authors, neuroscientists, investors, regulators, entrepreneurs, filmmakers, the list goes on. And so my question is, how important is it to kind of unite these segmented groups in this collective mission? And if it is important, what are some effective ways of doing so?
I don't know that it's so important. I think that this is, as I suggested in an earlier answer, this is proceeding along different paths. There is the underground, there is the medical path, there is the religious path. And I think that's okay. I mean, I think that I'd hate to see that the pharmaceutical industry, you know, take over this area. And there are people in that world who want to patent these things that have been out of patent or never patented. They're mushrooms. I worry about too much control, and I think a little bit of chaos in this marketplace is a good thing. I support medicalization and commercialization along that path because it's most likely to lead to access for people who can't afford, you know, a $1,500 guided psychedelic experience or whatever it costs now. And, you know, that if we pursue that path effectively, it'll be covered by Obamacare or, you know, other, you know, forms of insurance because it's proven to be more effective than whatever treatments are out there. And that's the best way to get access to lots of people. But on the other hand, I would hate to have I think psychedelics have a lot to offer people who don't have clinical diagnoses. And there are other reasons to take them. There's spiritual reasons. You know, people that's very important, and creative reasons. And so there are lots of different contexts in which they have value. And I'd hate to see us push one at the expense of others or try to unify. I mean, in a way, you do have different groups are unifying to, you know, get the laws changed in places like Oregon and Colorado. And I guess that's a positive thing. But I kind of think there's safety and diversity here, diversity of approaches. So thank you for your really provocative questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.